Hey everybody, welcome to the 52nd episode of the JDO Show. I am your host, J. David Osborne, and today on the program we have Mr. David Bowles, the author of Chupacabra Vengeance, which is out now from Broken River Books. It's available in Kindle. That means you can buy it, it can go onto your little magical device, it can go onto your fucking phone, dude. You can open up your phone, and there's a little Kindle app, it's a blue thing with a little dude reading on it. Fucking fantastic, and you can just read it like on your phone. Jesus Christ, technology is fucking amazing. In this podcast, we talk about appropriation, we talk about Mexican culture, we talk about writing, we talk about how to be a good human being, and we talk about David gives a lot of cool personal anecdotes about his life and his personal story. It's easily one of my favorite podcasts that I've done. I think that you will enjoy it. I hope that your day is going swell. And yeah, go get Chupacabra Vengeance. It's $3.99, dude. It's fucking inexpensive. 15 stories and you get all these illustrations and shit. Anyway, that's me. I'm in shill mode right now, so enjoy that shill and enjoy this 52nd episode of the JDO Show podcast show. Very cool. Yeah, we've been, you might find this surprising, but here in Portland, it's been steadily raining for the past week or so.
Well, that never happens in Portland. I don't understand.
It's very, very, it's bizarre, man. I don't even know what to make of it. Well, hey, David, thank you for being on the podcast, man.
You're quite welcome, Tocayo.
Tocayo. Oh, dude, we should do the whole thing in Spanish, and I could just do my, like, broken-ass Spanish and embarrass myself. Make for some good radio.
I totally think that you should have an episode where you get like Gavino and me and a couple other people who can speak Spanish, and we just like fuck with you the entire episode. That would be awesome.
Well, I told you, it was so funny when I used to sell ice cream when I first moved to Portland, and there was it was downtown, it was in the industrial district, it was called Ice Cream Express. And so at the end of the day, it was kind of a cool job because I had to sort of figure my own shit out. They didn't give me a route or anything. They were just like, I don't know. Here's the ice cream. Go get
it,
buddy.
Sell that shit.
Yeah, for sure, right? So at the end of the day, I would take it back and I would lock the truck up. And there was a Mexican fellow who was living kind of underneath Ice Cream Express.
Like him, wow.
Him and his girlfriend had like just made a little place for themselves like in underneath the grating under the factory, basically. And every time I would park the thing, he'd come out and he'd be like, oh, well, you know, working hard. And I'd be like, yeah. He's like, all right, well, you know, have a good night, Joto. And I would be like,
have a good night, Joto.
And I'd be like, and he would just laugh, like, because he thought that, like, because I would just wave back and be like, thanks, man, have a good one. But it's like, dude.
He just thought you didn't know what he was saying, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I was like, dude, I see you, bro. But so
you
yeah.
wish I were a Joto.
you want me to join
you're
you in your
after
lair.
This. Yeah, and you're oh my god, can you imagine? He lures you down with like I don't know, tamarindo and other kinds of like Mexican like dulces and stuff, and you're like, oh yes, right. Take me to your lair, Mr. Mexican man.
So have you always lived in South Texas? Are you a native?
Yeah, I totally am. I mean, I haven't lived here my entire life because my dad was in the Navy. Mm. And so like we did like a stretch of god it's like 7 years that I lived in South Carolina. So from the age of like 4 to 11 we lived there, and so we were I mean my wife oh that's a Freudian slip my mother oh shit
that's staying
my
in, dude.
my mother is Anglo-American and my dad's Mexican-American, so we were like the only Mexican-American family in a lot of these places in South Carolina, and we ended up living like in like mainly African-American neighborhoods, like you know, trailer parks where mostly black families lived, stuff like that. And so even when I was living in South Carolina, I seldom lived around white people, and here in the valley I've lived around Mexican-Americans pretty much my entire life as well. So it's always weird if I go to a conference when there's just like mostly white people, I feel very, very strange. Even though I'm half white, it's just like, well, how do you behave around all these white people? It's really strange.
Right.
But well, yeah, my family's from down here. My parents graduated from McAllen High School back in like the late 60s, and their parents were born here. And I guess like my great grandparents came from different places. Some of them came across from Matamoros. Others came from like Oklahoma. Others came from like Missouri. So it's like little ranches and parts of Texas. They all kind of like gravitated to the Rio Grande Valley.
Deep roots pretty much in,
yeah,
in that
yeah,
area.
Totally.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that thing about white people because when I got out of high school, lived in Orlando for just a little bit, but after that, Rios and I moved to El Paso, where I went to I went to UTEP for a couple of years, and El Paso was very similar. I think it was something to the effect of like 85% Hispanic Mexican.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know? And it's really weird to kind of live your entire life as, for lack of a more delicate term, like the standard race, like the standard color, right? Like wherever, like, cause you know, I'm from Oklahoma.
Right.
Very, very white. And then to move to a place where all of a sudden it's like, oh, hey,
you're the minority.
Exactly. But you know what, man, it was kind of cool, honestly. Like,
yeah,
it was, I met very interesting people and there's a lot of, I don't know, man, I'm just a big fan of Mexican culture in general.
Sure.
Rios gives me shit sometimes because she's like, well, it's just because your people don't have a culture. And I was like, oh, that's fair.
This sounds like something my wife would say as well. My wife's from Mexico. And so she berates not just white Americans, but like just Americans in general, Mexican Americans too. She's like, todos son iguales, hijos de su pinche madre. She's goes off on these rants. It's hilarious because, you know, people from Mexico like take their culture very seriously and like, you know, appropriations of it or whatever are looked upon with like major anger and chagrin.
Now, can you?
But yeah,
that
must have been kind of a freaky thing for you to go from living in Oklahoma to living in El Paso.
Yeah, but I was always just like, you know, high all the time. And like, I didn't really get scared of much, even though I probably should have. Well, no,
see,
I mean,
there's a lot of peyote out that way, isn't there? Well, I mean, there's a lot down here where I am too. So
yeah, dude, totally. Well, the ones that I actually have never done peyote. I've always done it in the form of San Pedro cactus.
Oh, okay.
Right. That's, that's where I've gotten my mescaline from. But, what was I going to say? Oh yeah. You mentioned like appropriation. Now, can you explain to me like what exactly constitutes that? Cause I hear people talk about it and stuff. So is it basically like, I know that Rios gets really pissed off when she sees like white girls paint them, like on the Dia de los Muertos, paint them, their faces in sugar skull makeup, or like on Halloween, basically, because they wouldn't even do it on Dia de los Muertos.
I think there's a major difference between like appropriation and integration. So like, I think it's easy to understand appropriation if you first understand what it means to actually explore other cultures and take elements of them and then integrate them into your personality. So like, you know, a white guy who decides, oh, you know what, Buddhism, that's going to work for me. So he like, you know, studies with Tibetan monks and like, you know, really gets into it. And so, you know, he is breaking apart his own identity, removing the shards of his like own religious upbringing, whatever. And then like, you know, through bricolage or whatever, like putting in these new pieces of a different culture into himself and like integrating them into, you know, his self. And that kind of thing, that's, to me, that's not appropriation. And people who like genuinely have great respect for cultures and study them and live among those people and integrate some of their customs into their own self, I think that's fucking amazing. I think that's what we all ought to be doing is, you know, learning about other cultures, studying them deeply and, you know, finding things to better about ourselves. But when you're like, oh, that shit looks really cool, I'm gonna wear that, you know, whatever native design on my skirt by Gucci because it just looks badass. To me, you know, that there's where you start getting into this idea of like, you don't actually have any kind of real respect or understanding of the culture. You just think that something looks kind of cool and you're going to then take it without any of the underpinnings of it, any of the philosophy or, you know, cultural roots, and you're just going to use it so you can look badass or, you know, so you can be clever. And I think people who do that are just like dicks in general and pretty like shallow vapid motherfuckers to begin with.
Right.
So it's like they're the people that you just expect it from. And so I think that sometimes people go overboard. I can tell my wife sometimes you're going a little overboard.
I'm sure she likes that.
Yeah, for me to tell her that she's going over it.
Oh, I'm sure she responds very. She well
reacts
to that.
Really. Yeah, no, she does. She does. She just lays down and lets me walk all over her. No, she's like, ¿qué dijiste? Che cabrón. Nada más porque eres güero. Just because you're light skinned, she tells me. Yeah, there's yeah. some colorism going on in this household.
Oh, dude, oh, wow, that's so funny, man. Because like, yeah, we have that in common. And whoever's listening to it, like, I don't want people to get this impression that Rios is some crazy racist or whatever. But she does the same kind of thing. She's like, you're saying that because you're white. And I'm like, true. It's kind of true though.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is, like, so my wife comes from Mexico, and in Mexico, colorism is like. The mainstay. I mean, one of the like worst insults you can say to somebody in Mexico is to call them indio, pinche indio de la pata rajada. You damn Indian, you know, barefoot Indian or whatever. It's like a horrible insult, and they're mestizo people. You know what I'm saying? They're
right.
Mexicans are, you know, to some degree or another, they have indigenous blood. There's very few of them who are like pure, you know, Spanish. Although they'll tell you this shit. Ah, mi abuelito vino de España. You know, you're whatever. Your right, grandfather's right. from Spain. My ass.
Oh, no, that's so funny. Rios's mother would say stuff like that, and or no, it was either her mother or her sister. Anyway, yeah. And Rios is like, "What the hell are these people talking?" You know, like because her father is from Guatemala, and her mother's from Mexico. But like one of her sisters was like, "Yeah, no, my great grandmother lives in." Spain or something like that, and it's this weird thing that like you lie about to like be a little bit more like fresa or something like that, right? Like
there you go, and it's like it's like a holdover from colonial times, because you know that really complex caste system that they had in place, where like if you were, you know, you had the peninsulares, the people from Spain who were like they were the top, and then you had the criollos who were like they were pure Spanish but they were born in Mexico. And then you had all these different divisions. So, like, if you were, like, half indigenous and half Spanish, you were this. If you were three-quarters Spanish, you were this. And so that, even though it only lasted for, like, you know, 150, 200 years, became deeply ingrained in the nascent, like, Mexican identity. Mm. And so, you know, now, I mean, it's horrible. It's, like, this internalized racism that's a holdover of colonialism. And it gets really, really ugly sometimes. And, like, in Mexico, if you are a blonde, green-eyed Mexican woman, you will get like the most badass jobs. You will have like men falling. I mean, I guess this is kind of true of women, just anywhere. Mm-hmm. If you're a light-skinned Mexican guy, it's so much easier to get a job. Whatever. If you're a dark-skinned Mexican, you're fucking out of luck for the most part. Whoa. You know, it's just it's hard, dude. It's really, really hard.
That's why that reminds me of like in India. You know, they sell the skin bleaching creams. That's a big market over there.
Yeah, it is, dude. And like in Mexico, one of the biggest products is like shampoo with like chamomile in it to lighten your child's hair. So you like, you know, my wife used to do this to our oldest daughter when she was a baby. She would like wash her hair with this chamomile shampoo to lighten it. And like our oldest daughter is the one who's darkest of all. She's got basically like almost raven black hair. Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck? You're not gonna lighten black hair. You're gonna turn it like orange.
Right.
But it's just deeply ingrained, dude. And so there's some resentment too. So like we live 5 miles from Mexico. So we'll go like have breakfast all the time. And when she goes by herself to Mexico and she comes back, she always gets stopped. Her car often gets like searched or whatever, because I mean she looks very, very, she's dark skinned and she looks very indigenous. And then she'll be with me though, and they're just like, are you American citizen? Uh-huh. And they wave me through, and she's like, hijo de tu chingada madre. She just gets really, really, not because she's mad at me, but because she's mad at the system that allows somebody like me just to, you know, come and go as I please without any problem.
Right. Well, it reminds it reminds me of Gabino's. Every time Gabino goes anywhere, he'll he'll be like, "Oh, guess who's getting randomly searched at TSA again?" And he'll just be straight up taking pictures of the TSA agents, and they always look pissed off or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just like, man, that shit is just so. I mean, I don't know, man. It is what it is. But yeah, about the appropriation thing, to me, it always seems like whenever. People always want to take these kind of things and like make hard and fast rules about it. And
no, you can't do that.
Right. The interesting thing is that you just kind of have to go into every situation where it's like, how do I not act like an asshole here? Right. Like,
yeah, generally, I think that's great. You know, let's go through life not being dicks. That's like number one rule. If you can do that.
If native tribes say to you, hey, look, we don't ask much. We're really not asking much at all. But can you just not wear the headdress? And then you're like, well, fuck you, man. Like, I want to wear it to my
festival. Free country.
It's a free country.
To wear whatever. Yeah.
And it's just like, dude, just this one thing. Just this one thing. Just so. And I remember, yeah. I remember I posted like a couple years ago because it was really disturbing to Rios. And, you know, you get that whole kind of thing where it's like, I'm mad too because you're mad.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And so I posted this thing about the Dia de los Muertos, the sugar skull makeup. And people immediately on my just blew up my shit with, it's just like, you know, why is it bad? Why is this? And it's like, look, just this one thing. Like, can you just not do this? Just one thing. Just one thing. One thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But people,
and then you're like, and like, put it in historical perspective, you know, with like Native Americans. So, you know, so we decimated their population. You know, we killed off, you know, hundreds of millions of them, and pushed them onto reservations, you know, eradicated their culture, kidnapped their children. Can we just like not fuck with them in this one area? Is that too much to ask?
Right.
Or do we have to have it all? Do we have to have every single little bit of what's left of their dignity and pride?
Right.
Is that what you want? Yeah. It's like the way I'm with football teams. Like, why do we have to call them the Washington Redskins?
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why? Oh, tradition. What about their traditions? We fucking obviously don't care about that, you know? But the town that I live in, Donna, the mascot is the Redskins as well. And I taught in the school district here and then was like a central office administrator for a long time, heading up the English Language Arts Department stuff. And it's really tough to work because you, like, if you say something, you alienate everybody because they just accept it without even thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be times when I'd be like, you guys realize that we're 97% Mexican American in this town. You know, everybody here has indigenous blood, and yet we just, you know, flippantly use this term. I would tell people that were my friends and would listen to this. Can you imagine if the team was called like the, you know, the Donna, like, even something as nice as the Donna Mexican Americans would be what? And then if you went further and were like the Donna like Beaners, the Donna Greasers, or the, that would be fucking horrible. Or even like the Donna Aztecs would be like, huh, what?
Why?
And so why are all those things, you know, offensive and irritating, but we don't have any problem with Redskins?
Right.
Yeah. So,
and then it's like,
then
it's just like, yeah, like you could go through that whole thing, and then it loops back around, and it's like, well, because that's tradition, dude.
Yeah, that's what we were always called since 1925. You know, and sometimes I get into the argument. I go, oh, so who was in charge of Donna in 1925? Because, like, dude, this area right here, it used to be part of, like, a huge Spanish land grant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when Mexico won its independence, the Mexican government, you know, respected the land grant. And it was, by that time, divided up into, like, a couple of big ranches that the like, grandchildren or great-grandchildren of those original grant holders had. And then around the turn of the century, 19th, 20th century, you had, an influx of Anglo-Americans who were looking for a place to try out new agricultural techniques and so forth. And they were drawn to this area, and they bought up a lot of this ranching land, like, super cheap, because, you know, now the descendants were like, fuck, we're tired of ranching. You know, these cows are a pain in the ass, whatever. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
But all the people whose livelihoods depended on all the actual, they're like basically villages on these ranches, were now pushed to the margins of these new, like, boom towns that Anglos set up. And they would be pushed basically in the Mid Valley, where I live, south of the railroad tracks. As the railroad tracks were laid, the Mexican town was south side. And basically this, like, burgeoning hegemony of whites created a lot of animosity. And then there was from 1910 to 1918, there was, like, the Mexican Revolution, and you had revolutionaries sometimes crossing over and raiding the U.S. side. And so around 1915, the fear of the revolution spilling over into the valley was so high that the president sent, like, 100,000 fucking troops into the Rio Grande Valley. There were not even 100,000 people living here, and there were 100,000, like, federalized National Guardsmen. And they all these Texas Rangers with, like, field commissions and shit. And these guys, they lynched 2,000 Mexican Americans who had, like, nothing to do with anything, who just happened to be, like, in the wrong place at the wrong time, or look sideways at them or whatever.
Fuck,
and so there's, like, all this animosity. And so then when people say stuff like, oh, well, you know, that team name has been around since 1925, I'm like, and who fucking called the team the Redskins? Yeah. The white people who were in charge, dude. So here we are now. Mexican Americans have taken back the town. They're, you know, that long enduring, like nearly century long hegemony has died. And what are we doing? We're just continuing. We've like so internalized that identity that we've become kind of like what Paulo Freire calls like sub-oppressor. So we're, you know,
what now? I'm sorry.
So Paulo Freire, he's like this Brazilian. Well, he's dead now, but he was like this Brazilian educator and philosopher. And he talked a lot about he has this really famous book called The Pedagogy of the Oppressed.
Okay.
And he talks about how like oppressed people, and this fits really good with Marx's conversation, the last conversation yet. So I'm not a Marxist by any stretch of the imagination, but what he talks about is when you have two different groups, the people who own everything and the people who work it for them, that underclass, they identify being human with the overclass. So when they're given a chance to rise above it, to become like, you know, I don't know, like an overseer on a farm or something like that, you know, how sometimes you'll get, you know, one of, like, think under slavery, like you'll have like, you know, an African American slave who is then allowed to like work over other slaves.
Yeah.
That person then becomes crueler even than the master himself. Mm-hmm. And so he talks a lot about how that's what's called a sub-oppressor. So in the Rio Grande Valley, you get all these Mexican Americans who, you know, rise out of poverty and they get an education. And then they're put in charge of like a school district or their city commissioners or the mayor, whatever. And they use the same sort of like political tools of political oppression and corruption and so forth that white people were using for decades before them. And there's really never any change. It's just like we've changed the color of the skin of the people who are oppressing everybody. Yeah, and that's it.
Well, no, it's interesting, dude, because in my first book, actually, it's based in like 1952, in Siberia. And they would do that in the gulags, right? Like, so basically in a gulag, you would have something like 2,000 to 3,000 prisoners, and you'd actually only have between like 15 and 20 real guards, because what they would do is they would take the Vorvasakone and make them lieutenants. And they would get like special stuff, like, I don't know, warm water to take a bath in, or like extra bread. And like you said, they would become like the most brutal, more brutal than the guards would be even. And so in the 1953, I believe, that's about when it started, there was something called the Suka Wars, which Suka basically means bitch in Russian. Because these guys who went over to the guard side were considered, they were called Sukas. It was this mass kind of like rounding these people up, and they would take sandpaper or glass and make them cut their tattoos off or rub their tattoos off their skin. Because the Russian mafia at the time and today, like, they're very, very serious about their tattoos, right? Like everything, it's its own language, and they feel like if you have gotten a tattoo in, without deserving it, or, you know, you've lost the right to wear the tattoo because you've traded sides, you have to remove it. So a lot of them were killed, but a lot of them just ended up like essentially carving hunks of their skin out to get like these
God
tattoos
damn,
off.
Dude.
So it's interesting that's
that kind of, I mean, I vaguely remember some of that stuff from like reading Alexander Solzhenitsyn when I was in my teens and in early 20s. I went through that like Russian stage. That's badass. I've never read your first novel, although I've heard you talk about it in previous episodes, and I definitely need to check it out, because it's that kind of dynamic I find like really, really intriguing.
So that's what the book is about. Basically, it's a guy who's taken a position as a suka, basically, and like the chickens are coming home to roost, essentially. And like he's like losing all of his friends, and people are turning on him. And it also like follows a Polish prisoner. And anyway, it's all a lot.
Holy
of
shit,
fun.
That's like a really ambitious thing for you to have written. Like, what were you like in your early 20s when you wrote that?
I wrote it when I was 21, 22.
God damn, dude, that's pretty impressive. That's really cool.
I got much less ambitious as time went on.
Now you're like, fuck, I'm just gonna write about what's happening right now.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. It's like I ate some chips. You know, it was. It's crazy.
I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that research.
No. More. Yeah, well, I had a copy of Anne Applebaum's Gulag, which is a great resource for that. And it's also just a really good read if it's something that interests you. And I felt of a fucking vulture, man, because I just had sticky notes all over it. And I was like, ooh, that's good. That's really fucking morbid, you know? Like, so I would just, like, all the worst things that I could find, I'd be like, I'm going to steal that. But,
Well, you know that I love research, man. You can tell in my work that I'm always researching stuff. So I know I eat that stuff up too, just diving into things and you have, of course, I mean, you have to be careful because it can be a rabbit hole and it can be hard to climb out, and you've got to balance it with the actual fucking writing of whatever it is you're going to write.
Right. Okay, so what do you think for you, what's the division of labor between research and actual writing?
Well, I mean, the smart thing is to only do as much research as you actually need to tell the story, right? Because, you know, your reader doesn't, you know, he doesn't need to know all the ins and outs, and you can just hand out shit or whatever. But the reality is, like, in order to, like, really live in the world, you need to know a lot more about it than is going to be on the page itself. And So I tend to spend, you know, say I decide, oh, you know what, I'm going to write a short story that's set, you know, during, like, it's set in medieval Japan. And so, you know, I'll just read some stuff set from that time and do some research, whatever. So I probably, you know, you invest a lot more time, you know, say a 5,000 word short story takes me a week to write and revise or whatever, but I probably will, like, do at least a week or maybe 2 weeks of research if it's like some kind of historically set thing. And I mean, a lot of times I find myself compelled to write about stuff that I've already researched because I tend to, like, you know, to stay in a particular era in history or a particular culture once I've really dug into it. So, you know, I've spent like a decade now learning Nahuatl and researching the Aztecs and that kind of stuff. So, like, I know that world really, really well, and that is a lot easier. I just have to kind of, like, refresh myself. Like, oh, I'm going to set it, you know, in 1450, and that's right, 1450 there was a famine because there'd been, like, you know, no rain in the highlands or whatever. And so I just go back and look over, like, one of the dozens of books I have about it and just kind of refresh my memory, and then I can dive in. Because, yeah, writing about something new, shit, you know, it's a lot. It's, you know, 75% research, 25% writing, I would say, for something completely new, which is exhausting, dude. It's fucking exhausting.
Man. No, it really is. And it, what you're talking, like, the fact that you're – so you – I mean, like – but you do a lot of, like, historically based type stuff, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, that's a pretty – and it's interesting because I was reading Julio Cortazar, like, his lectures that he gave at Berkeley in 1980. And he talks about, like, his own kind of progression. And he said that when he started, he was very much just kind of in conversation with literature itself, right? So he was writing a lot, like, about himself, basically, and, like, books and things like that. And then he said he entered what he called the metaphysical phase, which is what he calls, like, hopscotch and stuff like that, where he was trying to write multiple characters from multiple perspectives. And then he said he moved into what he calls his final stage, which is historical. And he kind of starts talking about how a lot of authors move this way. They write about themselves, then they write about a bunch of other people, and then they, like, start becoming focused on, like, history.
Yeah. I'd say to me that resonates. That sounds very familiar to me because I look back at the things that I was writing in my teens and early 20s, and a lot of it is very much focused on myself and on my friendships and the things that I was going through and, you know, that kind of shit, and, you know, the world of college and fucking insanity that goes on when you're, like, loose from a very religious family into the completely unrestrained environment that is a liberal college, and then I went through my metaphysical phase as well, where I went through stages abandoning Christianity because I was my dad was a pastor.
Didn't know that.
Yeah. My dad was a pastor, which is kind of ironic because he was, like, raised Catholic, and then he when he went into the Navy, he started dabbling in, and part of it was probably because of the curanderismo in our culture, but he started dabbling in, like, Santeria and shit. And I remember when I was a little kid, he used to like have all these like books on magic and so forth. And then he became like a born again Christian when I was 7 years old, which is you're like, what? Oh shit.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're going to paint over the pentagram in the garage, are you? And,
well, it's all just, and, look, it's all just searching, right, dude? Like he's just,
yeah,
he's,
I think it's all searching.
Something. Yeah.
So I spent a good time and he left us when I was like 16, but I still clung to religion for the longest time. I thought I'd been called, that I was going to be like a minister and stuff, and or maybe the director of like music for a church or whatever. Cause I was a musician. I had a Christian band, Christian rock band in the late 80s. Woohoo.
Like Striper?
Yeah. A little bit more like grungy than that. But yeah, basically that was the time of Striper, dude.
Yep.
And so I went through the stage where I went from being a Christian to being more of like I started exploring Gnosticism, so I like really, really got into reading all the Gnostic Gospels and like getting into this really kind of like head trippy kind of, you know, a lot of times drug-addled way of looking at Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Gnosticism, I moved into being an agnostic, and then moving into being an atheist, and then I think I've actually kind of like moved away for the longest time. I was an atheist, one of those. I was never one of those radical, in your face, you know, I'm going to go around and proselytize so that the whole world is atheist. I was never one of those, but
mm-hmm.
I think my atheism has softened into something that it's humanist for sure, but it just doesn't really, like, it's not. People can believe in God or not believe in God. I don't even really give a shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm much more concerned about people's ideology and how it impacts their relationship with each other and with, you know, with the earth and with our future and things like that. And I don't think that we can get rid of religion. I think that religion has an important role to play, but I think religion simply has to begin to evolve more quickly. Obviously, religion has evolved over time. Christianity has evolved and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But we need that like cycle of mimetic evolution to like speed up, because right now religion is like lagging behind the rest of the cultural evolution that we're going through. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons that we're in the sorts of problems that we have right now in the Middle East and the U.S. with Trump and all this bullshit. It's because, you know, religion is still kind of lingering in this, you know, parts of it in the Middle Ages, parts of it like kind of in the Enlightenment a little bit, but certainly nothing in not even in the 20th century, much less the 21st.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so I went through that stage where I was exploring all this stuff, but yeah, now I've definitely gone more historical. I mean, I write about it and think about it, and in a scholarly way as well as in like this fictional cool way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting that you were talking about you know, how we have to kind of evolve and stuff. And I think that that's kind of like the root of the whole problem, right? Is that, you know, we have extremely old brains, you know,
yeah,
and shit just keeps getting, it's like fractals, man. Like it just keeps getting faster and faster and faster. And we still essentially have caveman brains, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We have brains from 100,000 years ago. That's right. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. And so it's just like, I mean, and that's why I think, you know, religion, I mean, I'm actually like, I think Gnostic Catholicism is pretty cool. Like there's a lot of stuff I like about that. I like reading about it more than like, I'm not like a
practicing it. Yeah.
Basically in the morning, I just do the Bene Gesserit prayer from Dune.
that series, well, especially that book, but that series and it's like cultural religious milieu were are really, really amazingly prophetic in a lot of ways. I think he had a handle on stuff that was going on with his time spent in the Middle East or whatever. And
mm-hmm.
when you go back and read it, you could just see, I mean, it's kind of hard to express what I see as being so prophetic about it, but just the clash of religions and the blending of religions and so forth. I think it's,
and also, really, really, I mean, also the giant sentient worms too.
Yeah, I mean, because those, I mean, clearly we've created those in labs now, and they'll pretty soon be taking over the entire planet.
That's what
we need, dude. We need to have giant sentient worms just, like, devouring cities and turning everything into spice.
Right.
And then we'll just take a bunch of spice and be high all the time, and everything will be fine.
Yeah, and our eyes will be super, super blue, so we can all,
blue. Like, we'll all have blue eyes, and so we won't be, like, you know, that will calm my wife and your wife's like irritation with blue-eyed people. They'll be like, okay, well, we all have fucking blue eyes now. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's todos somos güeros con ojos azules. It's right, okay right, now. Right.
No, and it's like, and it's so funny too, because you know, as soon as they would switch over to blue eyes, they'd be like, actually, blue eyes are pretty cool. You know.
Yeah. Now that I've got blue eyes.
Oh, that's so funny.
There's this shit where they could like take a laser, dude, and yeah. like burn off the brown of your eyes and turn man. Your eyes blue. Can you imagine? What kind of fucking damn. Person is gonna like, please shoot a laser into my eyes and burn off the color? That's what I want.
I mean, yeah, man. I mean, it's like, but I mean, think about like just any plastic surgery at all. You know what I mean? Yeah, like, yeah, yeah. I mean, and sometimes it's necessary. I get that, you know. But like anybody who like does like the Botox or like, there are people who like, and please do whatever you want with your body. Like, I'm definitely not shaming. I'm just saying that the concept is weird that you would cut a part of your body open and put, yeah. you know, something underneath it to make it more pronounced. Whether that's, I've seen dudes get calf implants, women get breast implants, butt implants, you know.
You know what's irritating about all that to me? And like you, I'd never shame anybody, and everybody can do with their bodies whatever they will. But and what strikes me as disappointing about modern, especially modern American, modern Western plastic surgery and so forth, is that it's unconnected to anything of value. When you look at, say, you know, like indigenous peoples or, you know, different tribes in Africa, whatever, and, you know, scarification or tattoos or, you know, whatever, it was always connected to some deeper truth, some kind of religious practice, some, you know, vision quest or, you know, whatever the fuck, but it was something, there was something of cultural value to it that was unconnected to just turning other people on. And I just mm-hmm. think that so much of modern plastic surgery is about, I need to get more sexual partners.
Yeah.
So I'm going to carve myself up so people want to fuck me. And I just, I mean, I don't think that people like actually think that, but I think it's clear that for the majority of people who are doing this, it's about sexual attractiveness. Occasionally, it's about just feeling good about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, that feeling good about yourself
is directly
comes from how other people look at you. And so, right. I mean, it's hard to get around that. Anything that you do to your appearance is ultimately about other people when they look at you.
For sure.
Because you're not standing in front of a mirror all day long. You don't get to see the stuff that you do to yourself.
Yeah.
And that's fine. I just wish people would, like, you know, I just think people don't own up to it. People are like, oh, no, I'm doing this for me. I don't give a shit whether anybody else likes it. But, you know, like, so somebody does something, like, really radical to their face. Like, they have, like, reptile scales tattooed to their face. And then they have, like, I don't know, screw-in horns implanted into their skull.
I met a guy with horns a few months ago at the Lovecraft Festival. I didn't meet him, but he was giving a presentation.
So you have to ask yourself, like, you do that, why? You know, right. you're not going to see those horns. I guess you can reach up and touch them from time to time.
Right.
But it's all, to me, and maybe I'm being, like, naive and old-fashioned about it or whatever, but to me it's all about the reaction you get from other people when they see you. Like, holy fuck, that guy's got horns.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah. And he split his tongue like a lizard. Holy shit, man.
Well, dude, it is what it is. And it's one of those things where, you know, I think that I think you're right, man. I think that it's totally true. And, of course, it's like I would never want restrictions on that. But
no, neither would I.
It is what it is. And I think that one thing that I've actually enjoyed doing recently is following porn stars on Twitter.
That's hilarious.
One, because you get some pretty sweet pictures. And then two, because – I swear to God, man, a majority of them are just like the realest people on the fucking planet, right? And they just they don't bullshit like that. You know, they seem to have a very clear understanding, probably because, you know, they work with their bodies and with sex, you know, pretty much all day. Like, they just it seems like they just don't have time for bullshit.
Pretense, yeah.
Pretense, there you go. Yeah. Yeah. And I just I respect that a little bit more than people who, you know, are just like, I want to feel better about myself. It's like, well, have you tried like eating a carrot or something? Or
yeah,
you know, like, it'll make you feel pretty good.
Learn a different language. You know.
pick up a hobby.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. Just do some woodworking.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, you know, people's over fascination with their own bodies is, and part of it is just, you know, I realize that there's a bias because, like, I don't, like, I'm not particularly interested in that kind of stuff. And so, right. you know, because my interests lie in other areas and because I just have no fascination with like carving myself up, mm-hmm. it may sometimes be hard for me to understand why people do it. And like you, I definitely believe we should never have restrictions on that. People should be allowed to do with themselves, you know, what they want. In general, I think people should be allowed to do what they want as long as it doesn't interfere with other people's ability to do what they want. But at the end of the day, it is, I guess, amusing maybe, mm-hmm. or I'm bemused by people's self-deception, that they a lack of awareness of what they're doing, you know. Like you say, porn stars are like, I'm getting these breast implants because I need to look good when I'm having sex on camera. Right. You're like, yeah, that fucking makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's like, go get it's that your money. Go get that money,
yeah.
girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like, no, yeah, I do think that, I mean, even moving on from the what we're talking about now, I think that just the level of self-deception in general is just so, I mean, that's honestly, man, that's one of the things that annoys me about like social media and Facebook and mm-hmm. things like that is that, you know, because it's like, we had International Women's Day yesterday, which I think is fucking cool. And, you know, so I post a little thing, you know, it's like, I hope everybody had a good Women's Day. But I would see dudes like just waxing poetic, you know, about like the import. And it was just like the most patronizing, weird, like self-aggrandizement that. And it's just one of those. It's like, do you not, you don't see like what you look like, do you? Like, you're so in your own head that you can't like step back and realize that like, the last thing you should probably be doing on International Women's Day is taking up a bunch of space in a timeline talking about how important women are.
Yeah. Why not share the posts of women that are important to you?
Boom.
So
exactly.
You know, so that's what I did on Twitter. Like, I just like found a lot of really badass tweets by badass women and shared them.
Yeah.
You know, on Facebook, I said something like really short in the morning about, you know, hey, you know, because I kind of wanted to emphasize the importance of intersectionality on International Women's Day. And that was it. And then the rest of it was just like, you know, you just give that mic over to women on International Women's Day.
It's so
let them be in the limelight. Yeah.
No, it should be super easy. I mean, it's exactly the same thing as when, you know, whenever there's an issue with like with the wall or police shooting, you know, unarmed black men or, you know, the issues.
Promote the voices of the people that are being directly impacted by whatever it is.
Right, you know? Right. It's like, why do you have to say anything at all on the topic?
And if you are going to say something, because, you know, maybe you feel like really motivated, just keep it short and sweet and then get back to promoting those other people's voices, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, some, I think one of the, did I share this? I can't remember if I shared the tweet or not, but someone put something like, men, if you really want to celebrate women, the best way for you to do it is just not to rape us or beat us or silence us or whatever. You do that and we're good. You know, we don't need much else from you.
Just keep your fucking shit under control, dude.
Yeah. And that'll be great. You know, one of the best things, for example, as far as women's issues are concerned, that men can do is talk to other men. Yeah. So like, instead of self-aggrandizement, like you were talking about, get on and say, hey, motherfuckers, it's International Women's Day. So as you go about your day, don't be a dick to women.
Yeah.
That's all. You know?
Right,
and then
exactly.
try to keep that up tomorrow and the next day, and, you know, see how far you go. Yeah, that would be awesome.
Exactly.
You're gonna celebrate women. Yeah.
Exactly, man. And it's like, it's, you know, it's funny you mentioned intersectionality, and that's another area where it's one of those things where I don't really understand it. I get the basic concept of it. I do. I mean, okay, I do understand it, right?
Yeah, yeah. But, no, I understand what you mean by it.
It gets so complicated that it's one of those things where I just step back and it's like, I've appointed like my council of elders on things like this. And whenever I see something and I'm unsure of it, I just go to the council of elders and I'm like, what's going on here? And then they tell me, and I'm like, okay, cool.
To me, like, intersectionality is kind of like our conversation about appropriation. So there are people that overdo it, and like they're like, you know, this is probably like wading into dangerous waters, but
let's do it.
So, you know, fuck it, right? We're just going to alienate everybody. Who cares?
Let's do it.
So, you know, women on International Women's Day are like, just in general, when you're talking about feminism, the default setting for feminism is white feminism, right? And so, you know, I obviously live and am friend of many, many Latinas. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times they'll talk about how white women in their pursuit of the version of feminism that matters to them often forget that Latinas, that, you know, that Hispanic women are faced not only with the issues that face white women, but then a host of other issues that they encounter because they're also, you know, Latin American, that they're Latinx. And so mm-hmm. When white women are only, you know, they're only fighting for their white sisters, or fighting for the cause in a way that's only going to really benefit white women, then like African American women and Latinas, and then Latinas who are also like queer or whatever, their voices are being drowned out by the hegemony in this activist group. And so, I mean, you know, basically a lot of times you can just tell a white woman, hey, can you please remember like your brown sisters? And the white woman's like, oh shit, yes, of course.
Yeah.
And the solution's fixed. But then of course there are some people who want to turn it into like this interesting war. And you're like, again, because we're men, we stay the fuck out of it. But there are times when I kind of like want to lean towards a Latina friend or my wife, or I'll say it to my wife, cause whatever, she's going to fucking kick my ass no matter what I say.
Yeah, exactly.
And say, wouldn't you be better served by like having greater solidarity instead of like fighting amongst yourselves? But then of course the problem is that if that solidarity comes at the cost of shutting down the specific issues that Latinas and African American women face, then,
right.
Then fuck solidarity. I mean, I get it. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. I get it. Mm-hmm. Even though you and I may not necessarily experience that ourselves,
yeah.
As you know, as dudes, who are,
I happen to be, you know, I am Caucasian. That is,
yeah, and I'm half, and you know, and so, and then I, and my Mexican half is, you know, in terms of colorism is light skinned and privileged. So mm-hmm. It's like, fuck yeah. So that privilege that we experience, the same privilege that allows me to get across the border without any problem, while my wife is being like, you know, I'm surprised she hasn't been strip searched yet or whatever, mm-hmm. Is something that should, you know, give us pause. But at the same time, I think that if we're respectful and we listen, that from time to time, it's okay for us as allies to give advice to them. And I think that when you have some people in whatever movement that say, no, no words from you at all, you're like, okay, I think that at this point you've taken it too far, because you're now saying is that there is no way that someone who is not a woman can have anything to contribute at all. And I get the concern about mansplaining. I get the fact that men have this hegemony over our culture and have for thousands of years. But you can't, I just think it's probably like dangerous, and not a lot of women that I personally know are this way, but I think it's probably dangerous to completely shut out any kind of input from men at all, because they're also human issues. And I think that, you know, like if we're not willing to say, yeah, women have some, you know, great insights into men's issues and vice versa, then I just don't know how we move like forward in a way that's going to bring us together, because ultimately that should be our goal. Fix this shit, stop being dicks to each other, see each other as human beings, and like move forward, because otherwise we're not going to make it. Yeah.
Well, and I think that that's kind of what I've noticed kind of from the outside, is that human beings and like specifically like the lust for power has very kind of insidious ways of sneaking into any movement and kind of co-opting the language of that movement in order to gain some kind of social power over the others within the group. So, I mean, you will see on Tumblr, it does feel like it's a race to see who's the most oppressed, right? And then mm-hmm. various isms pop up, and it's like, oh, well, you know, I am, you know, a gay black person in a wheelchair. And then they're like, I'm a gay black person in a wheelchair with Lyme disease or something, like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And then whoever has the most oppression gets to talk. But that's not, I think the problem that ends up happening, because I do go to a lot of like right wing sites because I'm all about that balance, you know, the problem mm-hmm. with that is that they take those, which are for the most part, pretty isolated incidents, and they blow it up and they make it seem like that's what the entire movement is about. And
exactly.
Frankly, yes,
that's a major problem.
I spend a lot of time because of Rios in spaces with, you know, queer Latinas and stuff like that. And you know what, dude? Like, they're pretty chill, nice people. You know what I mean? Yep. Like, they're not sitting there. You know, the first few times I go to hang out there, I'm not going to lie, I'm a little nervous. I'm like, am I going to fuck up and say something stupid? And then everybody's going to hate me. But, you know, it's like everybody's pretty chill. And especially, you know, I remember I talked to a friend of mine once. They were really, really helpful with helping me to figure this out because I had all these problems. And they said, listen, dude. Like, a lot of these people are, like, super young. And I know that that sounds patronizing, but it's like they're super young. They just got out of college. They're trying to find some kind of identity, like, and they're trying to find a purpose and a cause, exactly. And I remember that. I remember when I went fucking vegan at UTEP because I had a vegan professor named Steve Best who was actually featured on the PETA episode of Penn & Teller's Bullshit.
That's hilarious.
Crazy guy, but he had this wild kind of charismatic way, like this kind of fuck you attitude. And I was like, fuck yeah, I'm going to eat bean burritos from Taco Bell. And I just got, after a week, I got so sick because I had no idea what the fuck I was doing. Anyway, but yeah, but the point is that, like, you know, these places, they blow this shit out of proportion. Like, this whole shit, like, you know, what's going on college campuses? Not much, dude. I mean,
yeah, like, people are in fucking classrooms, dude, or they're smoking pot out behind the dorms. Dude,
right.
That's basically it.
And you can find these isolated incidents in, yes, extremely liberal, extremely privileged, ironically, normally pretty extremely white areas. But like, you can't take like these two or like Berkeley, like really, that's going to be like what we, that's going to be like all universities, or you can go to OU, dude, like go to UTEP. Like, it's just, it's not.
You're talking about the Milo incident, right? With the,
Which I have no sympathy for. It's just like, I don't give a fuck. Yeah. Like, burn it. Mace those people. I really don't, like, in the grand scheme of things, like I have a very loose, because my whole thing isn't based on hard and fast rules, you know, like where it's like, it's never okay to punch. It's like, no, sometimes.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to punch, and most times you're not going to, but sometimes, fuck yeah, you've got to punch. There's just like sometimes, for the most part, you follow, like, this is the way I raise my children. Mm-hmm. You know, for the most part, you follow the rules, you follow the laws, you obey, whatever. But there are times when laws and rules and people in authority are wrong and hideously wrong, and they have to be opposed. And when that happens, then you oppose them, because to not do so is just, it would be wronger than to obey them. And like my oldest daughter is completely different. She lives in Austin. She's like almost 25. But my younger two kids, my son, who's like a sophomore in high school, he's like a major social justice warrior. Mm-hmm. And my middle child, Charlene, who's queer, she's 20, or she's almost 20. She, for a long time, was also kind of social justice warrior, but she's moved away from it a little bit, like extreme Tumblr-esque kind of thing you were talking about, because she's like, it's toxic, Dad. Like, you get drawn in to this increasingly like fragmented and rarefied kind of, you know, like prattle, basically, she calls it, and it pulls you farther and farther away from like what is really, really important in society to fight for.
Right.
And she talks about how she goes, you know, a lot of young people, she went through this stage where she was really, really confused about gender. And she goes, one of the problems with gender and trans issues, she goes, trans people need to be respected and they need to have rights and so forth. But what is happening with some young people on these sites is that they're becoming convinced that they're trans because they don't see that the actual issue is that the gender norms need to be pulled down, that the problem is, you know, allowing society to dictate to you what it means to be a woman. And she tells me, so like, when I realized that,
being like non-binary, basically, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, there you go. Not being. She goes, when I realized that, and part of it was just like, she and I would have like these long talks, and I would tell her, you know, as a man who is not at all interested in what other people think a man should be. Like, I define for myself what a man is. I don't give a fuck if somebody's like, ay, joto, estás muy femenino. Chinga tu madre. I'll be whoever, I'll be how I want, and the rest of it is irrelevant to me. She's had to discover that for herself as well. You know, I'm going to be the kind of woman that it makes sense for me to be. But that doesn't mean that I'm not a woman. It just means that what American mainstream society says a woman ought to be is bullshit. And yeah. and once you realize that, then you're like, oh, fuck, okay, well, you know, maybe I don't have to be thinking about operations and all this kind of stuff. And in her case, and then she was like, well, you know, she, you know, gradually just worked through stuff. And I just told her, give yourself time. Let's talk, think about stuff, read, reflect, you know. And she basically, you know, realized, no, what the issue is that I'm a queer woman. I'm a bisexual woman. And I need to find, you know, what it means to be a woman for me. And once she realized that, she said she felt freed not only from the strictures of, you know, mainstream America, but also from the strictures of the far, you know, SJW.
I remember, man, I saw this tweet from this woman. Left. Yeah, this woman who was like going on a quest that if you weren't part of the BDSM queer community, you weren't allowed to use the term daddy to refer to like, you know, a significant other or something like that. And it was funny because it was like, obviously, right, like the height of the absurdity of this like word policing kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's so funny because, yeah, it's a tool that I think is really, really good when used correctly. But of course, people start wielding that like a weapon and they don't do the self-work. So it's really cool to hear that your kid actually took the time, and because that's what people need to do, right? Like on all social media, across any issue, everybody's talking about like what's wrong with other people. Even if that person is someone as loathsome as Steve Bannon or Donald Trump, they provide these kind of like avatars that you can project all of your hatred and everything that's wrong with the world is because of these people. And the whole time, right, what you're doing is you're giving yourself permission to not like do any kind of self-work whatsoever.
And exactly. It's so much easier to foist all responsibility for the situation you're in onto this enemy that, you know, you've straw-manned up out of you know, people, problematic people, but people who are clearly not demons.
Yeah. 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 Do you have a little bit more time, or do you have somewhere to be?
No, I've got plenty of time.
Okay. Cool. I was going to take a bathroom break real quick, but then I actually, we're going a little bit longer than we normally do, but I think it's cool because it's a cool conversation. But I did want to actually talk like writing with you, if that's cool.
Yes. All sure. Right, cool. Yeah, let's take a break and we'll come back and talk writing.
All right. Sounds good. I'll be right back.
All right. You back?
Yeah, I'm back. All right, cool.
I was sitting here, like I was listening to you like move around and stuff like that, and I was thinking to myself, that's right. I need to get. We were talking about, you know, non-binary. I need to get like my little gay stuff out of the way. I need to say that Brian Allen Carr has got pretty eyes, really, really pretty eyes. It's so distracting to like be talking to him. Well, when he was living down here, we would like have like lunch together or whatever. Uh-huh. And I would like constantly have to avert my eyes because like they're like mesmerizing. Like, fuck, dude, yeah. I can't be looking at your eyes. Well, it's like really uncomfortable thing to like tell him.
He's a very severe looking man in general. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like he's very angular. You know, he has very high cheekbones and, you know, and yeah. And then those
eyes. And those like, eyes are like startling. You're like, fuck, dude. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
And,
yeah.
And then Gabino's biceps, dude.
Whoa. I know, dude. He gets so shy about that shit, but it's like, but dude,
The first thing I'm going to do, you got to let me feel your biceps, dude. Come on.
They're fucking huge, man. I guarantee you. Yeah, I know. Like they're as big as my fucking like thigh.
Like it's holy crazy. Shit.
Yeah, dude.
That's awesome.
I was like, Gabino, tell me how to do, how to get to look like you. Right. And he's like, well, dude, you have to eat first. And I'm like, oh, damn it. Right.
that's the tough part right there for you. Got to remember to eat.
I forget to
and
eat, man.
Lots of protein.
I'm like, Rios thinks I'm fucking crazy because she'll be like, when was the last time you ate? And I'll be like, I'll think about it. And I'll say, probably like 9 a.m. And she's like, it's 6 in the afternoon. What the fuck is wrong with you? And I'm like, I don't know. I wasn't hungry.
That's the way my daughter Charlene is. I'm like, it'll be like 12. Did you have breakfast yet? She's like, oh no, I totally forgot. I'm like, God damn it, Charlene. You're like almost 20. You have to learn how to feed yourself. Like,
I'm 30, dude. Shoveling. I still don't know it, man. So I still don't know.
So yeah, so those are my like little queer passions right there, those two gentlemen.
Sweet. Yeah, I know. I'm on board with those. So yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about writing, mostly like because at least to me you appear to be very prolific.
I do write some stuff.
Yeah. So yeah. What is that like schedule like? Is there a particular time? Is there a particular ritual that you go through before you start?
Yeah, like for the longest time before I got the this tenure track position here at UTRGV, I would like, oh my God, for nearly 2 decades, the schedule that I began to develop for myself, that and especially over like the last decade, was get up at 5 o'clock every morning, drink a shitload of coffee, and write from like 5 until 6:30, 6:45 or so, and then, you know, iron your clothes, take a shower, go to your 8-to-5 job, and like be a, you know, this normal person, blah, 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 and then come home, you know, help the kids with their homework, spend time with the wife, and then around 9:30 or 10, sit back down at the computer, look over what you've done, revise, edit, make plans for the next morning. And I would do that Monday through Friday, and then my wife was super cool. She would allow me on Saturday and Sunday to block out either the morning or the afternoon and have like just 4 hours of uninterrupted writing.
That's
And you'd be
awesome.
surprised what you can get done, dude. Writing, you know, an hour and a half every day, and then 4 hours each day on the weekend, I mean, you can potentially put out a lot. And you know, part of my apparent, well, I guess it's not just apparent, but a part of this production is just having written over the longest time, and having, you know, a backlog of shit that then can kind of be, you know, tweaked and so forth as the door opens wider and wider for you. And you know, it's, you know how things are. I have a kind of like Taoist mentality about this. I've always thought, rather than like go after publishing opportunities in a Machiavellian kind of way, instead of trying to like bend Tao to my will, I'm just going to work on myself. I'm, you know, polish my skill,
Boom.
get to be the best kind of writer possible, so that when the river of life, you know, draws me into these like these shallows, these places where I have an opportunity to climb onto the bank, I'm ready. I'm good to go. I'm ready to spring into action.
And isn't that
And
healthier? Like, you don't trip
I
out
think so.
about it, you know? You
Fuck
just
yeah.
fucking do what you want to do, man. It's just a better, like, you get to actually enjoy life on the way to the
Yes.
goal, right?
Yes, you do. And I mean, I didn't have my first book published until I was 40. And for some people, that's like, holy shit, that's like, you know, that's way too late. But it was the right time for me. And I mean, I had some things published before that. But, you know, those 20 years between, you know, when I was in college and realized that it's definitely something I wanted to do, and before, and actually getting published, you know, I wrote several books. I did a lot of stuff. I self-published some things, whatever. But it was all, I mean, I needed also just to experience the world. I started a family, raised children.
Yeah.
You know, I got 3 degrees. There were things that I needed to do to myself and take care of
Yeah.
internally and for my community and so forth, that made me into, I think, a better writer than I would have been otherwise if I had just been, you know, like this petulant young, you know, writer thinking that, you know, he's going to take over the world and he's going to knock down, you know, the gates of New York, and they're going to love him
See.
and give him a,
You
and
did it. You did it smart, man. And I
yeah.
really respect that you followed your path. I was that obnoxious young guy, though, and so
But
I can.
you've learned to not be that way
I've
though.
learned by getting my dick kicked in like 8 times. You know, like so hard that I was just like, holy shit! Like I was like, the phrase like young, dumb, and full of cum. It was very, very applicable to me. Like when I start, because I started, I think. When I was 18, I was like right out the gate, I was like, let's fucking go. And I was just like a fucking dick all the way up till about 25, 26, something like that. And then, yeah, I think I've told this story before, but it was actually Cameron Pierce who, like, we were drinking one night and he was just like, you've got to stop being such an asshole, man. And, you know, I really care about that guy and I care about his
Yeah,
opinion.
he's a fantastic guy.
Yeah, and so I just started like weeping, you know. I was like, I have been such an asshole, and he's like, yes, you have. And yeah,
Sugarcoating at all, dude. I love it.
no, like he just gave it to, but it was good, man, because I mean, it was like a light switch went off, and I just woke up the next morning like fucking Scrooge on Christmas morning, right? Like just
Yeah.
like, all right, I'm gonna be good now. And it's and dude, and that's the thing. And then, you know, you start to read more philosophy and things like that, and it's like life is just better when you're fucking chill and happy and nice to people.
Yeah.
It's just better.
Yeah. And you know, and the things that you do, like, you know, Broken River, I know that it's caused you some headaches and heartaches or whatever, but it's about reaching down and pulling other people up and giving them, you know, a foot in the door. And I found that, as trite as it might sound, you know, the more you sow those seeds of goodwill and community and so forth,
yeah.
and you stop focusing on your climb to the top, you suddenly turn around and like all these doors are open and people are like, come through the door. Come on, hurry up. You know,
right.
We're waiting for you. And you're like, fuck, when did that happen?
That's exactly it. And it's like when with Gavino with Zero Saints, you know, the reason why that book did so good is because he did exactly what you said. He spent 5, 6, 7 years just being that guy. If you needed a fucking review, Gabino was going to be your man, right?
Yep.
And he was just nice also. He was just kind. And so when his book came out, I mean, of course it's a great book. And of course, he worked his ass off to promote it. But people also wanted to buy it first and foremost because they like Gabino.
Yes, there you go. They're like, he's a badass guy. I bet this is a badass book. And I think that really is, you know, just part of it. And so the successes that I've had in the past couple of years, you know, getting the award from the American Library Association, which like you know, really helped.
Congratulations, by the way.
Oh, thanks a lot, man. Has like led to my, you know, getting a couple of like, you know, really nice contracts with like bigger publishers and getting my, you know, my first like actual decent advance and working on a TV series that hopefully will be greenlit pretty soon. And like all these opportunities opening up, and it's just because you put in the work and you're doing things for the right reason. You know, a lot of people would have never, you know, I just felt so much compassion for like Latino kids, not having mirrors, a place, you know, not seeing themselves in the literature that they were being asked to read in school, whatever, that I just really felt compelled to write the, you know, this fantasy series that has Mexican American protagonists and, you know, and fiddles not with like European magic and mythology and monsters, but with, you know, Mesoamerican stuff. And because I was doing it all for the right reason, because everybody, like every agent that I sent the proposal to and then, you know, the manuscript to when it was done, they all like rejected it, saying, this is, we can't possibly market it. You don't have, there's not a single like Anglo-American character in this book. And I'm like, well, there's one. And like, yes, he's a bully and he's an asshole. That's, you know, how are we going to get people to buy this book? And they're like, Mexican-Americans don't read. But, and I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? I've like, I'm a Mexican-American. I know my last name is Bulls, but and I have worked in education for the longest time. These kids do read, and school districts will buy this book. But it just, it was such a hard sell. But I just kept plugging away at it and plugging away until I found, you know, a smaller press out of Australia that was trying to break into the American market. And so, you know, once it was published, it's like it's also filling a niche that needs to be filled. And it got a lot of really great response. And so this stuff pays off when you're doing it for the right reasons. And like you say, you're living your life and just trying to be a decent human being and letting things flow instead of like trying to make things happen. And trying to make things happen is the best way for them not to fucking happen to you.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, because like whatever you want to call it, God or the universe, like I used to, it was so funny because it would happen like clockwork. I really wanted to be a full-time writer, right?
Yeah.
And so I would get freelance gigs and I would have a big windfall because it always seemed to happen at one time, right? So I'd take this money, I'd take like this $10,000 or whatever, and I'd be like, all right, I'm quitting whatever bullshit job I have right now and I'm making it happen, right? And pretty much as soon as I quit that day job and took my $10,000, like all the work just dried up. And I would just watch the savings deplete and I would, you know, but I would be stubborn about it and I would wait until I was just almost jumping, like having to go out onto the street or whatever. And then I'd get my job, a day job back. And then the freelance gigs would roll in and I'd start getting contacted from people and stuff. And it was just like, the universe just wants to see you cry if you do stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it wants to humiliate you.
Because basically, I mean, obviously there are things that you control, but there are small things about yourself and your own day-to-day life. When you try to make things happen on like a grand scale, you're like trying to, you know, put your shoulder against the wheel of the world and turn it in a different direction, that shit doesn't work.
Nope.
And I mean, I know people, I mean, there's a particular author that I've known for a long time who who has now got like this best-selling series, and he's got like a show on the Sci-Fi Network or whatever, The Expanse, and to kind of make it in the business, like he put his marriage on the line. He got dropped out of this very lucrative job he had. He moved from Southern California to New Mexico, and you know, became part of a writer circle with J.R. Martin. Mm-hmm. Like, he put it all on the line, and he made it. But it's mm-hmm. very unusual for somebody to gamble everything and make it. Typically, when you gamble everything, you fucking lose everything. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, when I saw what was happening with him and saw how dangerously close to the edge he was walking, I was, you know, kind of nervous for him, and it worked out at the end of the day. But I just know that if I fucking tried that, it would destroy. You know, every time that I've tried and to make the universe bend itself to my will, the universe is like, "Fuck you, that's not gonna happen."
Right.
Guess what? Guess what? We're gonna break you, and you get broken enough times, you know. But to be honest with you, David, being broken is not such a bad thing. It hurts
good.
Really bad,
no, it's good.
But it's good. And I think that I actually have a book of poetry that's called Shattering and Bricolage. It's kind of like about my philosophy of like bettering yourself as a person. And if you're lucky, after you've been broken a couple of times by other people, by life or whatever, you begin to realize that the aftermath of being broken, you know, the putting yourself back together allows you, now that you're broken, to like, as I mentioned earlier in our conversation, pull out shards that don't fucking fit anymore or that you want to get rid of, mm-hmm. and then find, you know, bits and pieces of other people that would fit better and make you a better person, and to like reintegrate your ego into like this completely different person. And that's less likely to keep fucking up the way you were.
Yep.
But you will continue fucking up. And then if you're really smart, you find ways of breaking yourself. And so I've discovered you can break yourself deliberately by, you know, like through meditation, through drug use, if you're doing like, you know, certain types of hallucinogens in a controlled, almost quasi-religious kind of way, and not just like a, oh, I want to get, you know, fucking high and do crazy stuff kind of
mm-hmm.
way. By dedicating yourself to someone else in an, like, Hinduism has this term, bhakti, right, which is like almost worshipful devotion to a cause, to a person. That's another way to kind of like break yourself down. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are afraid of deliberately breaking their ego down and then reconstituting it. But to me, it's the way I found peace, man. I was a mess when I was in my 20s, dude. I know. I listen to the things that you say about yourself, and I'm like, yep, I know. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. I totally recognize myself in a lot of stuff.
Well, what were your breaking moments?
Well, I the first breaking moment came for me when my dad abandoned us when I was 16, because that kind of like pulled the rug out from under me, as far as, you know, it pulled the center of the universe away from me. Mm-hmm. And so the religious foundations, and you know, because when somebody that you love more than anybody in the world like abandons you and like never speaks to you again, 'cause that's what happened. He like left and never spoke to us again. I haven't heard from him in 31 years, dude.
Holy shit.
So yeah, it's insane. And I mean, he actually lives in Oregon, by the way. A few months ago, I was like, I bet I could track down my dad in like minutes if I wanted to. And I found him in minutes, and he's like, lives on a horse ranch in Oregon. Got remarried and all stuff like that. That right there, that was the thing that broke. I contemplated suicide. He had taken us back to South Carolina because he got in trouble with the law in the Rio Grande Valley. And so we were there, and he like left us with like debt and no car and all that shit. It was really, really horrible. And so just like everything was falling apart, and the family's falling apart. My mom was a mess. And there was like a waterfall a few miles from the apartments where we were living. And I went out to the waterfall, and I like stood on the edge of it looking down like, you know, I should probably just like throw myself the fuck down. And, you know, it's, you know, I guess it was like 25 feet onto these rocks. I'm like, you know, hopefully I'll kill myself, but knowing my luck, I'll probably just like become a quadriplegic or something like that. But, and I'm just standing there looking, and then like, I look up at the, and this is like a really like a formative moment for me. I look up at this guy trying to get the guts to like throw my ass off of this thing. And the sky is like just bright, bright blue above the trees. and it's like completely still and there's like no birds or whatever. And it, to me, it felt like it was like mocking me. Like, whether you throw yourself off or decide not to throw yourself off, no matter what you choose to do, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because, you know, these problems that you think you have in the, like in a cosmic way are insignificant.
Yeah.
The sky will continue to turn over the earth. The earth will continue to spin on its axis. Life will continue on its way. So, you know, removing yourself from it or not, that it's, you know, whatever you want to do. And I was like, well, fuck, I want my life to matter. I don't, you know. And mm-hmm. so that mm-hmm. was one of those first realizations. And then going to college was like the first person in my family to go to college, and like having to grapple with like really unusual ideas, and taking some of these philosophy classes that just like pushed me way beyond the, you know, my comfort zone, and exposed me to ways of thinking about the world. And then, you know, like, you know, doing drugs and then getting married and having all these different, there are all these points along the way that pushed me into places where I kept getting broken. And you know what it's like being married to somebody and you care about them very deeply, but you're like an idiot. I got married when I was 21 years old, dude. Yeah. And, while I wasn't unfaithful to my wife, I did a lot of, I lied to my wife about things. So I was like really addicted to credit cards and stuff like that. And so, in the lying and then getting and having the lie discovered and the breaking of trust and like what it, especially when you're accustomed to thinking yourself as being, because you're intelligent and intellectual and, whatever, you kind of, you have this like really high opinion of yourself, and to be brought low and to realize that you're fucking trash just like every other person.
Mm-hmm.
That is hard.
Oh, yeah.
That is hard. And, yeah. And, like the first time also that I was like raving drunk and looking at my baby daughter, Nikki, in her crib and realizing, holy shit, like if something were to happen to her right now, what the fuck would I do?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, mm-hmm. all these little mm-hmm. things like that, like they break you up and push you to the edge of what you're comfortable with thinking about yourself and make you reevaluate all this. And so after a while, I began to look for ways to break myself purposefully because I found that it was valuable. And you can do it in a controlled way so that it's not damaging to other people and so forth, but it is about breaking yourself up. And, you know, regular meditation or reading things that are very difficult, learning a new language, exploring history, these are all ways to, like, to throw the accustomed rhythms of the mind off the normal even keel that they're on so that you can become a better person. Yeah. I don't know.
And you absolutely cannot let the mind speak to itself for too long. Because no matter what, like, you will look for ways to, well, I don't know if you saw my Facebook post recently, but it was when I was super, super bored and I reached psychedelic levels of boredom. Because I was at work and I had forgotten all my shit at home.
Oh, yes, I did. And you were using your notebook and shit like that as I read that.
Yeah, and I was like, and I literally, it was fucking crazy, man. Like, I lost 2.5 hours just because, unfortunately, one thing popped into my head. And it was that a friend of mine is coming to town and I haven't been able to find a reading for him. And I'm like, I get bummed whenever I feel like I, like, let my friends down, basically. And so, like, that thought popped into my head, and then literally when I blinked again, it was 2.5 hours later. I hadn't fallen asleep because I was standing up and I had been pacing around, but it was like that, you know, not to be too, you know, dramatic about it, but that was a minor breaking moment too, where I was, there was no escape. Like, I couldn't get away from my thoughts anymore. I couldn't look at my fucking phone. I couldn't pick up a book. I couldn't do anything because my phone was dead. Right. I went there with 20% battery because I thought, oh, I'll charge it when I get there, like an idiot. And then, yeah, but it was just like, it's kind of like what meditation does, right? It's like, you have to face down that, like that wall of sound that comes rushing up as soon as you stop being stimulated. And so, yeah, so I do the same as you, man. I do, a little, like, I'm getting more into physical exercise, but I try to keep a steady, like, just vitamins, meditation, occasional shrooms, and just try to keep booze to a minimum.
Yeah, because booze is just, like, bad. I mean, it, at the end of the day, like, thankfully, I've pretty quickly weaned myself off it. So now, like, I'll have, you know, on the weekend, like a Dos Equis or two or something like that. And just that's it. I'm not particularly interested in the stupidity that being drunk makes you feel. And I very few times when I want to dull my mind to that point, because I when I was young and didn't like have a handle on this process, I needed to, because it was the only way to silence like the stupid shit that was going on.
That's right.
But now I've weeded that shit out, and so I mean, well,
isn't it, or have a process. Isn't it weird that booze seems to stop the internal voice by just like, it's like it turns on a spigot and all the stupid shit that's floating around in your head just drains out of your mouth. You know what I mean? Like, that's how you get it out. You know what I mean? Like,
and so that, which is not fun for the other people around you, right? They're like, God, I didn't want to be party to that. Thank you very much.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, okay. So basically, that is fucking fantastic. So what is, after we now have Chupacabra Vengeance,
which is, Chupacabra Vengeance.
It's fucking an ebook now. Fucking ready to go. Everybody should go pick that up.
They should be downloading that shit now.
They should be downloading that shit right now, dude. It's $3.99. Come on.
Like, yeah, dude, that's that's a fucking for 15 stories.
Hell
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. And you know, imagine that half of the stories resonate with you in some way, and you enjoyed them. That's pretty good, you know.
That's 50
cents.
Bad.
Yeah, that's not too bad. Yeah. So yeah, I think people will dig it. I mean, again, sometimes I have this issue where, because of like how sometimes unusual the subject matter is, or the maybe the unusual approaches that I take to it, sometimes people are, you know, like, oh shit, you know, like Benoit, like, I'm not sure that I really get all the stuff that you're referencing here, but you know, it was a hell of a ride, and and that's why I just encourage people who are interested in, you know, reading some speculative fiction that will take them to maybe some like different places than they normally are accustomed to going, then they should definitely check it out.
That's the Broken River way, man.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And you're very quickly establishing like a library of these books that do that sort of thing. It's pretty fantastic.
Sweet.
So people should totally pick it up. And then I've got, like, in the fall, I've got this book coming out, like a more like traditional book from a more traditional press called Feathered Serpent, Dark Heart of Sky, Mexican Myths. So this is like my like more scholarly, but definitely accessible to the general audience. I mean, it's just that it's the culmination of a lot of scholarly work, retellings and translations and retoolings of a bunch of Mesoamerican mythology, kind of like in a chronological epic kind of way, because there's no Mexican like Odyssey or Iliad or Aeneid or whatever, or Ramayana or something like that, but because, you know, conquest and burning of codices and shit like that.
Right,
so
right.
Yeah, so what I tried to do, and I've been working on it for about 5 years, is like put together a kind of chronological narrative, you know, pulling from different cultures, Aztec, Mayan, Purépecha, you know, Tarahumara, whatever it happens to be, and create like from the beginning, from creation all the way to the conquest, this kind of like mythological history of Mexico. So that's that book's gonna be kind of cool.
That sounds hopefully people will tight, dude.
Yeah. And so I mean, I do that kind of stuff. I'll do like a scholarly book a year, and then like, you know, like some crazy ass shit like this, and a young adult book is usually well. So people find that like really like some people are look askance at me, like, you know, putting out 3 books a year, and I'm like, that's what I want to do. So fuck it, whatever.
Yeah, no.
I'm gonna try to get it down to 2, but yeah.
Nah, dude, man, I'm all about authors becoming just like production machines. I mean, it worked for Stephen Graham Jones. So I mean, like the whole idea of, you know, you should only put out a book every 2 years or 3 years because you'll oversaturate is just, to me, it's fucking silly. You know, you're gonna piss off the people who are the completists, basically, who are gonna get frustrated that they can't get everything and read everything by you. But most people are not completists, and
no, they're not.
You're giving them a smorgasbord, right? Like, just pick what you want.
Especially if you're writing different things. I mean, like, right. if you're publishing the same 3 books every 4 months, then, you know, maybe you should fucking like find something else to do with your time. But
exactly.
If you're doing radically different things, then I think that, you know, that there's room for it. And also, if you're writing for radically different audiences, it's like my young adult audience is probably not going to, at least not right now, read, you know, Chupacabra Vengeance, which is obviously pretty R-rated in a lot of places.
So. Yeah, it's a little rough.
And Yeah, it's a little rough in places, and so there's some shit happening, and there's some language. Yeah. But and then of course, you know, the people who are like reading like my translations of like Aztec and Mayan poetry may not be picking up either one of those things, and so you know, I just happen to have these interests, and I just happen to love to write and whatever. I mean, I'm gonna do what makes me feel happy.
Yeah. And it's like Takashi Miike's films. You know, it's like the guy comes out with four or five movies a year, but you know, I'm not gonna go watch like the Power Rangers movie that he does, because he does kids movies and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm not gonna go watch that one. I might watch the gangster one, and then it's like, okay, he did like a cartoon musical of, you know, whatever. I'm like, I'll probably pass on that one too. You know what I mean? Yeah. So it's exactly what you're talking about. It's like, it's all things that are interesting to you, but you know, it allows you to kind of like have different people who are like, oh man, I'm really into his scholarly shit, but Chupacabra Vengeance, man.
Yeah,
I don't know. I don't know about that guy, man.
Like, oh yeah, trust me. I have these conversations with like other professors at the university that are like, because it's my first year on tenure track, instead of doing like the yearly evaluation at the end of the year, it had to be mid-year. And so, you know, my department chair is like reviewing my publications. And so there's like these different, you know, scholarly things. And then there's like, oh yeah. And I, you know, there's also Lords of the Earth and then Chupacabra Vengeance. And there, you can just see the looks in their eyes. Like, I don't even know. You know what, how do we classify you? What the fuck is this?
It's like, you don't classify me, bitch.
Yeah, don't. That's right. That's exactly the point.
Right.
Soy, lo que soy, yeah. And I mean, that's about it.
Right on, man. Well, hey, thank you so much for your time, dude. This has been fantastic. We
Yeah, no, I had a lot of fun talking to you, man. And, you know, keep rocking on, dude. You, the stuff that you're doing with Broken River, stuff you're doing in your own writing is fantastic. And when you move to El Paso, maybe I'll be able to catch you around. I'm up that way sometimes. I'll be there next month for the Texas Institute of Letters thing, getting inducted into the Texas Institute of Letters.
Congratulations.
I'm gonna read from Chupacabra Vengeance to all these like stuffy old people.
That's tight. Cormac McCarthy's in that shit, right?
And yeah. Dude, Sandra Cisneros and fucking Larry McMurtry and
wow.
So yeah,
look at you, man. Well, congratulations, man. That's so fucking cool. Like, yeah. It's cool to see good people, you know, getting good things. Almost as fun as it is to see like bad people crying on social media because they can't get anything.
There you go. And a lot of that is, I mean, and you know, thanks for saying that. And it's I think it's an important lesson. Rejoice in the good things that happen to other people, because you know, if what you do is you stew, because I've done both. If you stew in your envious juices, then that fucking like just psychically drains you and keeps you from doing the work that you need to be doing. And it's a challenge, because you know, I see people who have been writing like for less time than I have, or like younger, you know, having like different types of things, but you have to be happy for them. And when you allow yourself to like legitimately feel happy for other people, that's fucking awesome, and it's liberating, and you're like, I don't need to feel envy. I need to focus on what makes me happy. Envy doesn't make you happy. How in the fuck does it make you happy? I think that's a really cool lesson. Thanks. Thank you so much, dude.
Amen.
A lot of fun talking to you, dude.
All right, talk to you soon, brother. Later.
All right, be well. Bye. Adios.